Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. We're delighted to announce that Schroders has become a sponsor and corporate partner of the Money Maze podcast. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent investment performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. A word on our other sponsor, Bremont. The Money Maze podcast team was lucky enough to be invited to their new headquarters just outside Henley, Oxfordshire last week, a stunning new facility architecturally. For me, knowing nothing about watchmaking, to see the process up close was fascinating. The intricate engineering, the complex high-tech machinery, the watchmaking rooms resembling a semiconductor plant with all of the attention to air purification and precision. And then you see the collections from Jaguar to Concorde, from the Spitfire and military designs to Bletchley Park, and more recently the Stephen Hawking watch. I do love watches, and I own a Bremont, and I think they're absolutely fabulous. If I asked our listeners which country has the world's largest sovereign wealth fund at over $1.3 trillion, quite a few reasonably would think it could be a Middle Eastern country. But if I then said this country has won more Winter Olympics than any other, invented skiing and introduced salmon sushi to the world, you would pivot northwest. You would, of course, know it's Norway. Prosperous, peaceful, and phlegmatic. Its wealth in large part courtesy of its oil riches and its sovereign wealth fund known as the Government Pension Fund Global. And today we're very fortunate to have Nicolai Tangen, its chief executive officer and seasoned investor, who's taken on this formidable challenge of managing such a vast pool of assets and with the world ready to comment on performance and much, much more. So Nicolai Tangen, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you so much, Simon.
Well, you're our first Norwegian, which is terrific. I'm just intrigued. Does a Norwegian child get brought up differently?
Probably a bit, I think. A bit more outdoor, a bit more kind of social democratic, I think. But apart from that, the same things.
So let's talk about your very intriguing journey prior to getting into the asset management space. Let's just start with your university choices in the army. And I'm not sure of the chronology, but talk me through your choices of education.
Yeah, so I went to school in Norway and then did what is called a Russian language course in the school for the armed forces. It's kind of part of the intelligence service. And we study Russian for a year and a half. So I did that, spent some time in Moscow, started at the Norwegian School of Economics, but then transferred to Wharton, which is part of the University of Pennsylvania. And then I started to work at Casino, which was then an independent stockbroker, now part of JP Morgan.
I also see that you have, along the way, acquired a degree from the Courtauld Institute, and you were at my alma mater, the London School of Economics. So how did they fit into the equation?
Well, that was a bit later. So I guess we're coming to my time at Edgerton. But after Edgerton, I took a break from my working life and did a degree in art history at the Courtauld. And then later on, just a few years ago, I did a degree in social psychology at the London School of Economics. And I'd spent so much time reading up on social psychology, various parts of it. I had met with thousands of companies and heard CEOs talk about leadership and organizational development. And I thought, hey, I need some more kind of academic research and input into this. So I did a degree there, which was absolutely fascinating. And I just think that's a must-have degree for all people. Social psychology, it includes everything which is interesting in life. What makes us tick? Why do you take risks? What kind of risks do you take? How do you make your decisions? How do you unbias your decisions? All that kind of thing. It's fascinating.
So I already feel inadequate because I studied economic history at the London School of Economics, so I don't have any of those skills. But we are going to just walk back a little bit, because having also spent a little time, as I did, in the Territorial Army, I wasn't called to the intelligence services. So how did you become involved with the Norwegian intelligence services? What did they spot in you?
Well, God knows. But the thing is that this was... At that stage, there was a mandatory military service. And so, you know, it's quite competitive to get in there, but they took in 16 people every 2 years and they gave us a Russian education. It's great, but very hard. I was the second worst student and I was nearly kicked out, but just about managed to scrape through. It's probably the toughest thing I've done.
Right. Well, we might come back to Russia later on, but let's just start with the first bit of your career, because how does a Norwegian become an equity analyst at Cazenove's?
That's a good question. I spoke to a lot of people at that stage and asked them, where does one kind of kick off? And some people said you should start in a partnership, because they just look at risks a completely different way than most other companies. You can join a big bank, but it's not their money. And so they think about risk in a different way. If you join a partnership, Cazenove was then a partnership many hundred years old. For a partnership to survive for hundreds of years, you have to think about risk in a particular way. And I think it was just an amazing grounding in doing proper work, think about risks, think about money in a very serious way. So it was an incredible start.
And in fact, that reminds me, Michael Lewis, in his book, The Big Short, closes with the interview of John Gutfreund, who was running Salomon and took Salomon public, and basically said, John, that was where it all went wrong, wasn't it? When it was no longer the partner's capital. And I think there was a eerie silence.
Absolutely.
From there to Edgerton, it seemed like it was an incredibly vibrant place. What did you learn there and who inspired you?
Well, Edgerton is a great firm. When I was a Cazenove, Edgerton was my biggest client, and I did a lot of work with Bollinger and John Armitage. And I would say, if I think about it, you know, who have taught me investing is those two guys. Bill on the kind of the risk side and risk management side, and then on the stock specific analysis and how to look at companies, you know, John Armitage, he's just incredible. A really, really outstanding. Not only outstanding investor, but an outstanding human being. Properly AAA.
However much AAA, there was obviously a burning desire to go out on your own. So you established AKO, and I believe that AKO are the initials of your children.
Yeah.
Tell me, why did you think you could do this on your own?
You know, it was wonderful to be there. I spent 5 years there, and then I decided to take a break. And that's when I did my art history studies. I had never thought I should set up a company on my own. But I was a pretty pedestrian art historian and thought this is not going to be particularly great. And I think we probably all gravitate towards the areas where we think we excel. And I realized I was better at looking at stocks than paintings. And so that's when I decided to set up. And both Bill and John were very, very supportive and helped me as a reference and so on at the beginning. And without them, there wouldn't have been an AKO Capital.
Right. But you decide to create a hedge fund. So you're going to be long and short. And why did you think that was the right structure?
That was the kind of things that I knew, right? So I think it's important when you start up something, you need to be credible and you need to know what you do. That's what I had been doing. You know, I had been working in particular in the small cap field, and that's how we started out at AKO. In a way, just use what I had learned. Investing is one of these apprenticeship businesses, and I think it's undervalued in a way how important it is to have been taught by somebody who's good. And that's not only company analysis, but it's also risks. How do you think about risks? How do you think about your balance sheet? What do you do when things go against you? And so from that point of view, I probably went to the best school I could with the Edgerton people.
So AKO was, by any standards, a terrific success. And we've had some very interesting investors on the show. I've spoken to a few ahead of our call today, and they've been incredibly complimentary about what was achieved there. And we'll come back to some of the parallels and lessons later on. But all is going well at AKO. Great numbers. Great reputation, different, you know, in a space that's very typical. And your friend Martin Slenderbrook, chairman of Robeco, says that you're not somebody who seeks the limelight, and yet suddenly you take one of the most public roles in the world, and you know about risk rewards. So just tell me, how did you weigh up that decision?
Just give you a few kind of words on AKO. Yes, it did go very well. We started with 500 million back in 2005. When I left, we were roughly, or the firm was roughly 20 billion. And with very strong track record. And I think what we were most proud of was the investor base, investing for many of the world-leading endowments and universities. And so it was a very meaningful setup from that point of view, because we made money for the universities. We also created the AKO Foundation in 2013, where I put part of my profit share and so on, and started with 10%, as it says in the Bible. And then took it to 20, 50, 75. And then eventually I decided to put all my whole stake into that charitable foundation. I think I'd reached a stage where, you know, the firm was just a much bigger success than I had ever dreamt it could be. I had planned the succession pretty much from when we started the firm. And because that takes a long time, right, to make a successful succession, and very few people do it actually in this business, you need to push forward your colleagues and the next generation several years before you decide to step down, so that the investors are really comfortable with them and trust them. And then you need to build a system so that it is process oriented and that the investment process is independent of the leading character. And so that is what we did. And we launched another product as well, you know, the Global Fund. So it wasn't just one alpha machine. There were several kind of alpha drivers with separate short team and long team and so on. So, you know, a whole group of people playing into this. And then I kind of felt, you know what, this has just been amazing. Great track record, wonderful people there. I kind of thought it was time for them to take over the firm. I thought it needed a bit of new blood, some new inspiration. And I think it's been very, very inspiring for the team to take over the running of the firm. And they're doing a tremendous job. They are just really, really fantastic people, the guys who run AKO now. They are close friends. I'm just so proud of them. And then, so what do you do then? Well, I thought, you know what, I'll go back to university. And so I had started the application process to go back to university. It was a particular program I was really interested in. And then I met this guy who said, listen, the job in the wealth fund, is that something you think about? And it just like struck me, it just hit me. Just like, bang, I was just completely speechless. Just like, wow. As a Norwegian interested in asset management and organizational development, it's the dream job. It's just unbelievable. I mean, what an honor. I mean, what a responsibility. To take over the running of the country's money, you know? It was just fantastic. And now I've been there for 7 months and I love it.
Well, let's talk about it, because this 1.3 trillion, I mean, I think that's the size of Australia's GDP. So, I mean, it is an extraordinary pool of capital. Let's just start at the beginning. I think it was it Jens Stoltenberg, current Secretary General of the NATO, whose idea or genesis it was? Tell me a little bit about the history and how it came into place.
It's one of the great success stories of this country, right? We struck the oil in 69, the day before Christmas Eve. On the last attempt, bang, found the oil. Then very clever politicians and bureaucrats thought deeply about it and thought, how do we do this? Well, we're going to avoid what happened in Holland, where they spent the money domestically and drove inflation and crowded out industries and so on. We'll basically put the money from the shelf into a financial fund. And that's what they did. So now the amount of money in the fund is twice as big as, I mean, the amount is twice as big as the remaining oil we have on the shelf. And in a way, you can argue that we found oil twice, because if you look at the 11,000 trillion Norwegian kroner we have in the fund, the oil basically accounted for 3 of those, and 6 of those are returns. And the rest is a change in the Norwegian currency. But, you know, we have twice as much return now as the money which we put in. And the value of the fund now is roughly £200,000 per Norwegian. And it's worth more than if you add on the value of all the houses, boats, cabins, you know, just everything that people have, net of debt. The fund is bigger than that. So it's just incredibly important. Last year, it accounted for 25% of the fiscal budget of the country. And that's by using, you know, on average over time, 3%.
So the only people who are really unhappy are probably Sweden, that dissolved from the Norwegian Swedish Union in 1905. And a few other governments around the world. And Holland wasn't the only one that spent oil revenues, perhaps unwisely. And I'm sitting in one of the countries that had the windfall as well. But we'll move on. Just basically summarize the mission going forward.
Just one more thing. What is generally underestimated is how important the politicians have been here. You know, there's been wide agreement amongst the political parties how this should be done. It's democratically anchored in the government. So all main decisions are taken in the government. And that means that you can see through volatility in a different way because you have that anchoring. There are a great group of people in the Ministry of Finance who basically set the mandate. And so there is a strict mandate and strict limitations for what I can do and what I can't do. And I think their role in the whole process has been generally underestimated. Mission of the fund. Safeguard the wealth for future generations. So it's a generational fund, but it's also a reserve fund. And so, for instance, last year when we had the COVID situation, I mean, I guess we still have, it has enabled the country to put in place measures which many other places can't do. There's a tremendous safety net in a way to have.
I understand all of that. And I guess that the fund is the largest single owner of stocks in the world. That presents great opportunity, but to a certain extent, it might also make you something of a prisoner. And we'll talk a little bit about that. But I know you've released your view and your strategy going forward. And I'd just like to uncover that a bit, because what I was intrigued with is you said, What we want to do is make sure we use risk in a slightly more productive way.
Yes, you're right. It's a big fund. We own 1.4% of all listed companies in the world. In Europe, we own 2.6%. So a very big owner. We are running the fund close to the index. Okay, it's an index near fund. And we have specific risk budget from the ministry, i.e. how much tracking error can we have on our investments? And we are not using the whole tracking error. Some of the risk has been accounted for by various kind of macro positionings. And those are the ones we want to do less of. And we want to do more stock-specific analysis and stock-specific investing, partly through negative selection. So for instance, last year, I mean, you remember the Wirecard situation in Germany. Now, we were out of that because of some very clever footwork from my colleagues. And we saved 1.4 billion Norwegian kroner by not owning that stock. And so that's the type of risks that I think we can take in forward through more negative selection. We also have negative selection through various ESG criteria. And so we have published a set of expectation documents, which lays out how we expect companies to behave. And they are kind of very much tied into UN's sustainability goals. But we operationalize all the documents and kind of put numbers on various climate measures, tax transparency, the use of water resources, and so on. And we run all of our companies through this, and then we sell out our companies which don't live up to our expectations. We divested some 300 companies this way, and that has actually also improved our performance a bit. So I think we can do more of these kind of things going forward. That's what I mean by using risk in a slightly different way.
So let's pause on that. We've had some very different views on this, on the Money Maze podcast, from Anne Richards, the head of Fidelity, and even Sarah Gordon, who is the CEO of the Impact Investing Institute, which is, it's all well and good in pursuit of valid ESG goals to divest, but you might even then end up selling your shareholding to a passive fund as opposed to being a shareholder in BP and helping them with that journey. So how do you think about that, staying on board and helping that transition take place versus just simply divesting?
We are divesting in two different ways. So one is what I mentioned, which we are doing internally, but we also have a Council of Ethics, which is a separate institution from us, and they decide on companies which are going out of the index. So for instance, coal, tobacco, some types of weapons and so on would be excluded from our index. So that's another way of doing it. Generally speaking, we really believe in owning and being an active owner and helping companies to improve and being a force behind that. That's the main thing we do. So improving the world through dialogue is very important. I mean, we meet with, last year we had close to 3,000 company meetings. And we have 14 people in the ownership division, which works with the analysts and so on and integrate that into company dialogue we have. So very, very important. And that is why active ownership is important, because active ownership and active investing kind of goes hand in hand. You need to be an active owner in order to have that kind of dialogue.
And as you review the mandate and at least what you are capable of doing, you come from a background where, you know, at AKO you would have shorted, you may would have lent stock. Are these aspects that you would like to be able to do?
Well, we do lend. We are a big stock lender, and that's been an important contribution to our returns over the years. So we still do that. We don't short straight out. We are not net short, but we can be underweight positions. And so that is kind of shorting in the oil fund world. It's not owning something is practically, for us, being short.
Which then brings me to private assets. I don't think historically it's been an area that the wealth fund has been in. You've talked about valuations being elevated, and we might come back to what that exactly means and dispersion around that. But private assets, how are you considering their place, from hedge funds with low beta to forestry with recurring yields?
There are some private things we do. I mean, we do real estate on the kind of the unlisted side. We don't do private equity. The reason there is mainly that the politicians are averse to paying the kind of fees, and ditto hedge funds. But we do use external mandates when it comes to our emerging market exposure. So pretty much, well, most of the exposures we have in EM is taken care of by these external managers, and they have done really, really well for us. And they are an important contributor to the returns. And we have a group of people who select these managers who have tremendous knowledge and processes and doing really well. So it's an important part of what we do.
And I think you've hired, or you have a chief real assets officer, don't you?
Yeah.
So I guess, how might this change over the next half a decade?
We have now been in the mandate now is also to make investments within unlisted infrastructure. So renewable infrastructure. And we made our first deal 2 weeks ago, actually, in Holland, where we bought the second largest windmill farm in the world. And we are very happy about that deal. It generates electricity equivalent to what you need to electrify roughly 1 million households in Holland. So it's significant. We expect to do more of those deals going forward. even though we are not in a hurry, because as you said, valuations are not exactly rock bottom here. So we are taking our time.
Well, you have the benefit of time, but I just want to come back to, it was your comment, I think, that there are no cheap sales out there in stocks. But my question, I suppose, is the US, by historic standards and most measures, is expensive. The UK, on the other hand, whilst very small, is historically very cheap. I think we quoted the other day Graham Sacker, Morgan Stanley's analyst, talking about it being at a 40-year relative low. How much can you, within your mandate, shift to make an important relative overweight that can affect performance when you see valuation skews?
We can do some, but there are, of course, limits to how much we can move exposures around because of that tracking error budget I mentioned to you. There is a rebalancing mechanism in the fund so that if proportion of stocks go above a certain level, we rebalance that and move into bonds and vice versa. So there is some rebalancing there. So when we have these sell-offs like we had during the financial crisis and also spring of last year, we are typically buyers in those situations.
So you own funds as well as direct stocks. I know we've had one of your investments, which is on your website, it was a Chinese manager, Redgate, who came on the show. And I'm just, I'm intrigued again about how you think about complementing your core index plus with manager selections. How are you defining where you want to hire specialist management?
Mainly in emerging markets. And what we see is that they are so complex, you really need the local knowledge there. And that's how we are using them. We are also using them in a way to help us stay out of trouble because they only invest in roughly 30% of the available companies in these markets. And hopefully, we are not investing in the ones with the most reputational risk. Even though, of course, we never get it completely right. And sometimes we end up indirectly having ownership stakes in companies which are controversial. That can happen.
Well, this probably brings us to this topic of behavioral analytics, neuroscience. I think maybe your LSE degree clearly helped you. We know Jack Edmondson, who's the deputy CIO at Oxford University, said that he attended your course at AKO on investment psychology. And this is something you were very keen on. And I think you believe it helps you understand whether the counterpart is being honest and trustworthy. Tell me about how you got there and how you're implementing that.
Of course, I don't work for AKO anymore, so I shouldn't talk about AKO, but let's just talk about this in general. I think it is interesting when you think about how many people spend their lives talking to people, whose job it is to get information out of other people, how little training we have in asking questions. You go into the average dinner party and look at how many boring men there are who just talk about themselves all the time and leave the dinner and don't know anything about the lady that they sit next to. You know, the art of conversation, I think it kind of have forgotten art in a way. What happened in Norway some years ago was this terrible disaster where this one person killed 77 kids at this camp. And afterwards, I read about the person who had done all the interrogation of this guy. And I contacted him and asked him whether he could possibly train us in the art of interrogation. Now, it was called interrogation now it's called conversation management because that's a bit less controversial.
That's a euphemism.
But basically, he made a course, or a three-day course, in how to do this whole thing. How do you prepare? How do you ask your questions? How do you follow up questions? Do you use open-ended questions? Do you tangle together various questions? Just how do you do it? And what do you read out of it? And what do you read between the lines? And how do you close meetings and conversations in a good way? Because, of course, that sets the scene for the next conversation you have. It's a phenomenal training. And we, of course, trained the analysts at AKO. And we also invited some clients along because there just isn't anything you can buy. I mean, there is one firm who's doing it, but we thought our course was better. And now we are doing it in the oil fund as well. So our PMs are being trained. And I think it's just an incredible education. And, you know, these guys wrote a book about it, which is coming out in English quite soon, which is worth reading. It's fascinating, really fascinating.
What's the book called?
I'm not sure what they're going to call it in English. In Norwegian, it's called The Professional Conversation.
When it comes out, we'll put it on the website in the show notes because that sounds fascinating. And I take your point about how many men particularly will drone on at dinner parties. I mean, I wouldn't say I know any of them, but they exist. So let's talk about this other issue. You've got forensic accounting, which is becoming more important. I think you're also doing linguistic analytics. So what does that mean?
That's really fascinating. It is just how you read between the lines and how the usage of various words, you know, just what it means. And we hired a team of forensic linguists. The thing with forensic linguists are, you know, many of them get to work in the police and they kind of analyze suicide notes and things like that. But a lot of forensic linguists basically take the education and then start at the university to educate the next set of forensic linguists who then continue to educate the next set of forensic. So, and that's how it goes. So I think at AKO, we were one of the biggest employer of forensic linguists, and they were just absolutely brilliant. And what is interesting is that they can read the transcript from a conference call and then can pinpoint where is the problem here? What are they trying to hide? And that is by, for instance, if you get a combined question with two sub-questions, the CEO choose not to answer one of them, or they kind of distance themselves by moving from I to we, or they change the history, or they use different kind of qualifiers in sentences and so on. So it's an art, but it's really fascinating to see how these language people can pinpoint problems even without knowing what kind of industry the company is in. That's what we did well, was to combine these various sciences into the investment process. So using, you know, forensic accounting, using market research, using linguistics and so on. Of course, it makes a job 100 times more interesting. And I think it has huge explanatory value in terms of performance.
I'm now thinking that I've got to ask these questions very specifically because I'm worried about what people might be saying about the way in which I ask the questions and read the transcripts. Anyway, I think you're also preparing your portfolio managers and athletes along the lines of elite athletes to be able to deal with headwinds and adverse situations.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I know you're a sailor, Simon. I also sail, and I was very lucky to sail with some of the Olympic sailors. And I just thought they were so professional. And I asked, what can we learn from the way you operate? And I think there were two things in particular. One was the debrief process, the way they debrief after each training on so many different categories. So it's kind of the process focus. And the other thing is what they call the bounce back ability. After having lost a race, what kind of risks do you take in the next race? How do you get back? And what is fascinating, why I love sailing is, well, for instance, you take ping pong. You basically stay in a room and you play ping pong. No externalities. You know, there is no wind, there is no nothing. It's just you and a ping pong ball, right? While sailing is very, very different. You know, you can be in the lead, the wind changes direction, and you are lost. How do you cope with that? What do you do in your next race? Well, you take the same amount of risk, okay? The same strategy. What is that like in investing? Now, Simon, you lose a fortune in July. How is that influencing the way you take risk in August? I bet it does. Should it? No. Does it? Yes. So you need to kind of work on that resilience and that bounce back ability. And that is why we use a psychologist, a sports psychologist. I'm sure you can use a normal psychologist, but then you just feel like I'm a patient, you know, I have to talk to a shrink and, you know, gee, what's wrong with me? But the thing is that you bring in a sports psychologist and you do that because you're a high achiever and you're a top performer, right? So it's kind of people think it's great to work with a sports psychologist. It's helped me tremendously in terms of developing my resilience and the focus on process and so on. We brought one in now from what is called Olympiatoppen. It's kind of the combined effort within the Olympic, various sports have this kind of Olympic cooperation. And we brought in the top psychologist from that entity to work with our team here. It's tremendous.
So would it be fair to say that what you're really trying to do is overcome the natural human tendency to move between fear and greed, which dictates so much of what we do and leads to so much bad performance?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The thing is that the frustrating thing with asset management is that in the short term, there is no correlation between your process and the outcome. You know, you can be doing everything right and you can lose your shirt. And it's not because you did a bad job, it's just because of the way the market moves. Whilst in the long term, there is a very strong correlation between process and outcome. And that's why you need to have that process focus. And that's what they're bringing into the picture here. Now, we're also using him to developing this thing here called the investment simulator, which I think is, again, a very cool thing. And so it is putting the learning from mistakes into a system. If you manage to move from 51% right to 52% right, well, you are a hero, right? So it's very, very important. And how do you do that? You look at everything you do. You look at your holding period. You look at your ability to be contrarian. You look at your mental state, which you can kind of read from your recent performance, et cetera, et cetera. And whether you have been successful in these type of situations before, that type of stock, that type of industry, this market environment, et cetera, et cetera. And so we're building all that data. We've got hundreds of millions of data points in the fund. It's all in the cloud, and we can use that data to feed back to us when we make decisions. So we have a big team working on the development of that now. And I think that could be really, really so interesting. Because the thing here is that in financial markets, how many crisis situations do you have? Okay, you had one with a Russian situation in the 90s. You had the dot-com. You had the big financial crisis in 2008-2009. And then you had the COVID. And so you perhaps have like three, four of these situations during your lifetime. How do you train? You have no training, right? So to build that simulator, which can take you through these stress situations, I think would be amazing.
There might be some people who know me listening, and they're going to say, gosh, Simon, you're not a sailor. How come Nikolai said that? So I've got to, just for the record, say I'm sitting in Seoul where there's a lot of sailing going on. I myself would possibly be the world's worst sailor. I'm a man for terra firma, but thank you for the compliment, Nikolai.
Well, I also call myself a skier, and it's the same thing probably.
So I'm intrigued because since 1998, the fund has generated, I believe, an annual return of about 6.3%. You obviously have very understandable guidelines. How would you like to be judged at the end of your tenure?
Good question. I mean, there are many things that goes into that cocktail, I think. I mean, one is, of course, the returns. I would probably judge myself more on the alpha and the excess returns, hopefully, than the return itself, because we have limited leeway in how we can structure the investment position. But then it has to do with the methodology and whether we have brought forward the process, the investment process. It's what we do on the ESG side. And we are very, very important there in terms of setting the tone. And then it's what we manage to do with the people here. I mean, how fulfilling they think their work is and how we develop the people here. 500 very, very accomplished people. I think a lot of the areas within the fund is really world-class. And I think it's going to bring that world-class thinking through across everything we do.
And if there are three things you would like to define the culture that you are developing, what would they be?
I mean, excellence is very important here. Huge amount of integrity and honesty. You know, those are the type of values we drive. It's a hardworking environment with ambitious people who really want to make an impact. So it's that kind of intrinsic motivation. Motivation you can split in two. You have extrinsic motivation, which is more, you know, salary and all you pay people. And then you, of course, have the intrinsic motivation, which for us is trying to do something good and doing something great for the country.
Also, as we go along as investors, we learn from our mistakes. I'd love to know, what are the investing mistakes you've made that have really been helpful in the long term?
Well, I made all the mistakes in the book. I don't think there's a single mistake I haven't done. I mean, personally, I think it's interesting, of course, that the big losses you have are normally balance sheet related. So as long as you have a strong balance sheet, you are generally okay. The big learning is, of course, also is to read fair and greed. And how do you do that? How could you really put words on the panic last year, for instance? Well, interestingly, from social psychology, we took some learnings from fear and how do you operationalize and look at fear. And fear, you look at it, of course, is kind of the amount of media about a topic. You look at how much disagreement there is between the specialists and what the doomsday scenarios are. And from that point of view, are probably hardly seen a higher level of fear than February last year. And then what are we seeing now? Well, we're seeing a pretty high degree of euphoria. You're seeing it in behavior and risk-taking in the quality of IPOs and so on.
So this balance sheet risk is, I think, spot on. Debt is what gets companies into trouble. And, you know, you can only look at the high yield index to see how low it is and how easy it is for companies with very questionable finances being able to raise large amounts of money despite suspect business models. How do you specifically want your PMs and analysts to really almost sort of red flag those companies in the universe that when we at some stage, and there will be a hiccup, whether it's introduced by inflation or rate normalization or another exogenous shock, how are you getting them to prepare for that?
The model here is very much to decentralize decision making. And so I don't hang over their shoulders and tell them what to do, right? But we decentralize mandates and the PMs run money, right? We don't have the PM analyst structure here. So we have a lot of people running money. And so we let them loose and do what they want. I do think there are so many ways to skin the cat. And I think with the way we do it here, it works really well, actually. So I don't instruct them to do anything. We allocate capital.
And what are your biggest gripes? Maybe that's the wrong word, but your biggest criticisms about the investing industry generally?
No, I should be very careful.
That's maybe why I asked the question.
It is a relatively short-term oriented business, right? I think there are not enough people who think properly about compounding and who have the patience. And I've been thinking a lot about time. How do you install that thinking, that long-term thinking, the compounding mentality? When you are young, straight out of school, and you want to make a killing every day, I mean, how do you get that thinking in? What is time? How do you install that type of thinking? I mean, ideally, you want to take all the analysts, put them 5 years at the top of a mountain in Bhutan with a monk drinking green tea and really understanding what time is. That's probably the coursing they should be doing. But I don't think we can do that.
Well, I get the time, but I also get maybe the value of history. And most people invested today weren't around in the 1970s. They don't know what it's like to live in an inflationary environment. there may or may not be a resurgence of inflation coming. It's been my perspective that it is, and it's going to surprise people on the upside. And I know you're trying to move away from sort of that top down and increasingly make sure that your bottom up process is as rigid and thorough as it can be. But this could be a pretty important shift in the landscape. We haven't had an inflation for sort of in 35 years. How do you want to, I suppose, diagnose the ramifications?
Yes. No, I think you're right. I mean, I am kind of in your camp on inflation. I think it could be the unexpected thing here. And of course, it's bad because it will hit both the bond market and the stock market at the same time. And we are seeing some signs of it, right? We're seeing it in plastic. We're seeing it in transportation costs. We're seeing it in minimum wages and tax and so on. So we are seeing it, I think. And the question is how surprising it's going to be on the upside. I mean, some inflation, of course, is good, but a lot is not so good. Now, when it comes to crisis, they're all different, right? Otherwise, there wouldn't have been a crisis. If we've seen it before, it's not a crisis. It's the new thing, which is really hitting you. When you have a nuclear meltdown in Japan, we haven't seen it, right? We don't know how important it can be. When you have a virus, you just really don't know. It's completely new. You know, the financial crisis is completely new. So crisis is always new. Otherwise, it's not a problem.
Well, on the subject of inflation, I will share with you, you may have read it, but Ben Funnell and Tern Droysma, who are the Morgan Stanley European strategists who now work for the Man Group, have published a really long-reaching study of inflation going back about as far as you can and its impact on assets. And it's a great study because I worry that there is a terrific amount of short-termism and a terrific amount of basically an absence of skill set in dealing with inflation, because so often I hear, well, a little bit of inflation's fine, but you know what? A little bit may be fine for some companies, but a lot is a big headache for many. Yeah. So maybe that's an advantage if one's preparing for it. I'd like to ask you some more general questions. You've been incredibly generous with the AKO Foundation. We had Sir Chris Hone on the show, who has done something very similar, you know, at TCI. What gives you the most satisfaction about what the charity is achieving?
The education of less privileged kids. Very, very important. This is not a political statement because I can't say anything political. But when you think about injustice and unfairness and how early it starts day one, right? With the type of stimuli you get at home from your parents. And it has to do with language, the type of food you get, the aspiration, the level of aspiration, the support, mental support, safety network, all these kind of things. It starts day one. And then it just increases. And you look at childhood obesity, how socially dependent that is, depends on where you grow up and what kind of parenting you had and what it means in terms of illnesses and pay gaps and so on. And then, of course, if you are very good and you've had all that support, you get into a better school, you study with other clever kids, you work harder, you get a summer job because that's what you learn from home that you should have. And you even may have a network so that you get one. You have better teachers and you have a better chance. So it's that whole unfairness and injustice which starts so early and which accelerates. So early intervention is just so important. So that's the most meaningful, I think, that the foundation spends time on. But I'm not on the board of the foundation anymore because that was not allowed. It was part of the principles of me taking this job that I should disassociate myself from the foundation. But it does some really great things.
And talking about resilience, what were your either one or two specific obstacles that came along the way that you had to overcome?
I've had some, but many of them were self-inflicted, I have to say, by taking on very difficult things, such as the one I mentioned in the intelligence service, which was very tough. I've been privileged compared to many other people.
And what advice would you give to a student who's thinking about a career in financial services?
I think finance is just incredibly interesting because it ties in so many interesting things, right? It's company analysis. Everything you use and eat and so on is produced by somebody. So it's the micro side. It's macro, it's, you know, it fits into society, it's monetary policy, it's legal issues, it's greed and fear and social psychology. And then things are moving all the time, right? It's a never-ending moving puzzle. And so it's just fascinating. But what I do think is, in order to stand out, you need to have something on top of an economic education. And that is important. And I think social psychology is really, really important. And then the importance of being contrarian, to be able to be contrarian, think differently from the other people. Because if you look at four squares and on the one axis you have right and wrong, and on the other one you have consensus, non-consensus. All the money is in one square, right, non-consensus. You need to live in a square where nobody agrees with you. Life is not the popularity contest. And my wife says, well, that's only people without friends who say that. But I actually do have some friends. But to be able to live in a kind of non-consensus square, that's important.
That's great advice, Nicolai. I'm going to take that on board because I think that I've been a contrarian investor, but timing is another thing altogether on this. So thank you for that very pithy observation. Changing tack, I'm told that at some point not so long ago, you decided to take a course in cooking. And I'm told that you essentially have become almost the Michel Roux of Oslo. So which two people, famous people alive, would you like to cook dinner for and what would you cook?
I'm no Roux. I did spend three months at the Cordon Bleu and I have a lot of respect for chefs. Well, if you think about the investing world, the person who I think is the most incredible guy is, of course, Bill Gates. I mean, you use your brains and your energy to set up Microsoft, make a killing, and then you use the same brain and the same resources to give it away. Wow, unbelievable. And you read his reports and you see how systematically he's gone about doing the various things, how he has eradicated various illnesses and how structured and systematic and clever his structures are. Hat off for that. If you look at the investors, well, of course, you know, my previous colleagues were fantastic, John and Bill, but I think Jeremy Grantham is really fascinating. He's also, of course, very environmentally and socially conscious. I think Stan Druckenmiller is an incredible investor. Very clever, very agile, changes his mind according to facts. So those were the two guys.
So I asked you the two questions. And as you said earlier on, the problem is the CEO only answers one. So you haven't told me what you're going to cook. Three courses.
Well, there you go. There you see. Oh, wow. What I did a lot of last year was on the barbecue, whole turbot on a barbecue. And I was eating at the various restaurants in London. There are three restaurants, I think, who specialize in that kind of stuff. And I was eating there and I was kind of to get the secret sauce out of it. You know, what you spray it with, right? Because you put together a spray of lemon juice, acid, and fish stock to get that one right. It's key, right? So you turn it and you spray, put it on the table, and it's just like incredible. What would you cook? What do you think I should do as a starter then?
Well, I'm not a sailor and I'm not a cook, so it might be. But I am sitting here in Salcombe and they drop off the lobsters at the quay and they're actually pretty good value. And I like to make a lobster spaghetti with my own tomato sauce with onions and mushrooms and lots of garlic and some wine.
Oh, that is good. I probably would be a slightly less portion than you. I'd probably make a crab, tagliatelle, some chili and lemon juice.
Fantastic. Well, I'm going to have no friends at the end of this podcast because they are now absolutely sure that I'm a fraud. But I'm going to ask you one final question. This made me stop and I had to reread it. And you say, if you're looking for something interesting to read during the holidays, I recommend Susan Cain's The Power of Introverts. And you said, if we could unleash this power, even greater things could happen.
Yes, I do think so. I think introverts are, it's underestimated how important they are and the type of power they have. And generally, we move the extroverts up in the organization because they talk and they're more visible and so on. But you just need to be really conscious about it. But I mean, if you want to read some other things, I think you should read Adam Grant's Think Again. The key thing there is what he calls to be confidently humble. And I think that's important. You know, you want to be confident in what you know, but you want to be in a learning mode and be aware of all the kind of things that you don't know.
Well, Nicolas, you have an immense responsibility running this vast pool of capital and a nation's expectations looking towards you. So the very best of luck with that. I would say that they are very fortunate to have somebody who thinks so seriously about non-conventional aspects of the investment management industry, as well as the obvious conventional aspects. And actually, I've been taking notes as this podcast has gone along. And apart from cooking and book recommendations, and I am going to be very careful at the next dinner party that I ask a lot of questions to my neighbors for fear of falling foul of what you quite rightly observe. And social psychology, I just hadn't really thought or processed that. And its importance beyond investing, but its importance in the investing world, it's definitely been underestimated by more than me. And so that's really great advice. So Nicolas, very best of luck with your job and with the future of the fund. And maybe we'll have a catch up in a year's time also.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. It's great talking to you.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.